Are you listening? Damn.
On this episode of the Endurance Hour podcast, pre-race muscle activation, training plans for first-time triathletes, the pros and cons of running hilly roads for a flat race course. Podcast starts right now. All right, this topic is strength training for swimming from Harrison's swim form analysis that Wendy recently did on our Endurance Hour YouTube channel. He writes here, I'm noticing that I'm getting out of breath with the new revised hand entry pull push mechanics we worked on at our lesson. I think it's because my arm muscles used during those motions are weaker and haven't been developed from prior swims since I wasn't using my arms properly. And in that motion, I can feel my arms, mostly triceps, getting tired on my 100s especially. I really need to get going on weightlifting routine for total body strength. So strength training for swimming. What are your thoughts on what Harrison has to say?
Well, first I want to point out that he went from about a 220 per 100 to now he's comfortably doing about a 140. Per 100 pace. So he improved a lot just by activating his lats and his triceps. And it all has to do with the swim technique. He commonly dropped his arm when he was breathing. So he was missing out on a propulsive force. So the fact that he's feeling his triceps is really good. And the fact that he's out of breath probably has to do with he's going so much faster. And he hasn't quite developed the conditioning yet with the new mechanics. Swimming is a technique strength sport. Once you develop the technique, even if you had a decent technique, if you have anything new, you have to develop the strength with the new technique as well as endurance, and then you'll start to swim faster. And so I actually followed up with him and asked him, you know, I just made a comment how he is going much faster, and that's probably creating the breathlessness, because generally what causes breathlessness is kicking too much, or if your legs are dragging. Both of those will increase your heart rate, as well as dropping your arm too soon when you breathe, and just an improper exhalation before your inhalation, which we fixed all that. And so I believe his breathlessness is due to the fact that he's actually swimming a lot faster, and he's just going to take some conditioning and time in the water. Regarding strength training, I think it's an important thing to do. I think when you do strength training specifically for swimming, it's important to target the muscles, the primary muscles you're using for swimming, which are your lats, rear delts, and triceps. And I think you just want to be careful about how you do that. I did a series last year, swim technique with resistance bands. We've uploaded some videos of me doing my favorite resistance bands exercises. And again, it has to do with swimming and making sure I'm targeting those swimming specific muscles. I also think when it comes to swimming, doing a lot of pulling with paddles creates that resistance, and it's more sport specific strength training for swimming. You know, you only use your swimming muscles when you swim. Sure, you can target them in the weight room, but it's really important. Time in the water is really important. With the technique, I would say more than the actual weight room strength training to become a stronger swimmer.
Mm-hmm. Do you get that feel in the water of your hands?
Yeah, it's definitely a feel in the water. And like I said, I think the strength training is important, but for a beginner swimmer like Harrison, I think he's right now going to have more bang for his buck with time in the water, getting that technique more dialed in, starting to use some pulling with paddles, as well as, you know, incorporating some, you know, light to heavy weight, you know, progression specific to the muscles that he's using.
One thing I constantly see when I'm swimming for my regular swims, the person next to me or a couple lanes down, it's pretty obvious, is they don't have that follow through, that tricep extension. And one drill that I've done, and I've always kept this in mind for my complete follow through of my arm, is to hit my thumb on my hip and flick it through. That way I know I'm getting a full range of motion after my hand entry for that complete extension, which will fatigue the tricep if you do it correctly. Do you have any other tips or drills to work on maybe exaggerating that flick through, if you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, definitely. And I think the follow through and the behind, whether you're hitting your thigh or your hip, I also talk about in swim technique, extending your arm from behind versus trying to extend by reaching in front. Mm. You want to extend from behind to maximize that pull. And doing a proper catch-up drill, I say proper because as a kid I learned how to do catch-up drill improperly, and now I teach it in all our swim courses that we offer on Training Peaks. I really detail how to properly do a catch-up drill, as well as the underwater doggy paddle drill that I like to use. That drill specifically works on that follow-through and extending from behind.
Now, what about the fatigue of the tricep? Is there should people be fatiguing their tricep if they are doing that little technique that I talk about with the thumb is hitting my hip? I make sure that I'm making some force when I follow through because I want to make sure that I'm doing the proper technique and the range of motion. So I exaggerate that to remind myself, okay, got my hand entry. Now making sure that I have all the way through, I'm going to hit my hip with my thumb. That way I have that little flick. Can that be done too much to create a fatigue in the triceps?
I think it can't be too much. I mean, like when I'm swimming and I'm specifically when I'm racing, I can tell when I'm getting tired, I make sure I'm touching my thigh. You know, that's the one thing I think about in open water swim triathlon as I'm racing is making sure I'm always following through on that part of my stroke. With conditioning, the fatigue will become less and less.
Yeah.
And you'll just continue to get stronger. And like, I don't notice my tricep fatigue. I notice more of the rear delt lat fatigue. Like if I'm just doing, you know, I've done a couple 10K open water swims, just swimming only events where I get out of the water and my lats are feeling pretty fried, which is a good thing because I'm a big lat. I pull with my lats. I can't do a pull up, but I definitely pull. My lats are strong for swimming.
Is that the biggest, that's the biggest muscle group involved in swimming, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on lifting in the weight room before or after a swim for that muscle memory or that, I don't know, if you're going to be fatiguing the muscle even more, would you do it before or after or none of the above?
You know, it depends. It depends on the person. For someone who's not feeling their lats while they swim, I encourage them to, you know, go to the weight room, do some lat pull downs, do some pull ups, do a lat activation movement in the weight room. So they fatigue their lats. So when they get in the water, their lats are so fatigued that they'll feel it when they swim. Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, like someone who doesn't have an issue with engaging their lats in the swim, usually like in the beginning of someone's season, I'd rather have them lift and then swim, and they're going to feel a lot more fatigued when they swim. And then as they're getting ready to prepare for a race, I encourage them to swim first and lift second since swimming becomes more of the priority sport.
A somewhat newbie triathlete, although he did his first triathlon as a 70.3, he would complain to me or tell me that when he's swimming that his shoulder gets fatigued too soon. And my initial reaction was, well, then you're doing it wrong because I don't think your shoulder should get sore. If anything, right, it would be your lats or your tricep. But I never saw his swim form in person because he's in a different state, but I'm guessing that he was just, I don't know, clawing his way through or really muscling his way through it to have shoulder soreness. What could cause shoulder soreness?
Yeah. The technique definitely causes shoulder soreness. I mean, the primary, when I used to coach on deck in Colorado, that was a primary part of my job as adult swim lessons on deck. And if people would come to me with fatigued shoulders or shoulder pain or any type of impingement, I knew exactly what was wrong with their stroke. And it had to do with them reaching too much, flattening out their hand, and dropping their elbow. Mm. And that's going to put a lot of strain on the shoulder. If you drop your elbow, you're not going to engage your lats. Right. And you're going to put all the stress on your shoulder, and you start to pull using your shoulders. So yeah, you know, in general, your shoulders are going to be a little bit fatigued. You're going to know that they got used and they got worked, but they shouldn't be fatigued to the point where you're like, wow, I'm really feeling my shoulders and nothing else. If you are feeling your shoulders and nothing else, then it's definitely a technique related issue.
Now here's on the tail end of that is your, for me, my chest will get tight or full. You know, after I get out of the water, it's like, oh my gosh, I feel like I just got a huge pump in my chest. And there's an idea that to counter all of this repetitive motion as a freestyler, that you should probably do some backstroke of some kind to change up the shoulders or stretch out your upper body a little bit better. Is there something to be said for breaking that up, or can you just be strictly a freestyler and be okay with the possibility of an imbalance in muscle?
When you swim, the chest is getting worked, the anterior delts are getting worked, and you tend to have like a swimmer, I don't know if they call it swimmer hunch, where swimmers can tend to be very hunched over because of the lack of mobility, flexibility in the pec muscle group as well as anterior delts. So doing that backstrokes is definitely going to help you reach and stretch this out. And I read that somewhere over the years, and I'm one to always incorporate backstroke into my sets as like a recovery part between freestyle hard sets or just as a warm up and a cool down. So definitely that backstroke is going to help stretch out that chest shoulder area and increase your mobility.
Is that something you maybe just a couple hundred in between or at the end? When would you incorporate a little bit of that?
I think like if you're doing a set where you're alternating like a fast 100 followed by an easy 25 or an easy 50, do the backstroke during that easy part. So within the main set, and definitely as a cool down, because you know, it's like with weight training, when you do strength training, you're tightening up your muscles. So it's really beneficial to stretch afterwards. So just like in swimming, it's really beneficial to stretch out the shoulders with backstroke after the main part of your workout or within, depending on what type of main set you're doing.
You mentioned something about kind of activating the lat muscles, maybe pre-workout, pre-swim. I experimented with this a little bit this year with activating my hip flexors and my legs and my IT band and those kind of things and stretching those out before one of my races. And it was before I actually swam and did the bike and run, but it was because I wanted to make sure that I wasn't going to be too tight in my hamstrings, or that based on the race at the time, that I wouldn't be super tight. I want to be as loose as possible, but I also want, you know, by doing some pre-activation with some bands. So I actually made a video recently and put it on our YouTube channel where I showed in just a matter of, it was 2 minutes, but it was a series of 10 legs being extended out to one side, inside, and then like knee ups, like a sprinter would do or something like that, one leg at a time. And I would do that circuit of twice. So 40 on each leg, 40 or 50, and do that twice. And then like, okay, I've pre-activated things, so hopefully a little bit looser before I go out for a run. I did it before a run, but I also did it before a triathlon, and I actually felt better. I don't know if it was other combinations, but I did it on purpose twice this year, because I only did two tries this year. And I felt like, well, that little change in pre-race routine, maybe it was a confidence thing, or maybe it actually did help my lower body and the flexibility or pre-fatiguing things so they wouldn't be too tight. Is there any correlation to what I'm saying here that may have worked, or could it be in my head?
No, definitely. And the research and the science is out there with mobility and activation before you go run. So common activation stuff that I like to do are clamshells, glute bridges for sure. Both activate the glute medius, which is the weakest muscle in most endurance athletes' body. It's such a tiny little thing, but it's definitely something you want to activate for injury prevention. And then there's stuff like called fire hydrants, scorpions. That's a type of stretching. So yeah, definitely do it with bands or without bands. Leg swings forward, leg swings backwards, leg swings laterally. So I follow a few people on Instagram and YouTube that their expertise is muscle activation and warming up. Now you can do the same thing with your shoulders. You can take bands, and some of the videos I have on our YouTube channel demonstrate a proper warm up with bands, but even just doing like some arm swings, forward, backwards. If you've ever seen Michael Phelps, he usually leans forwards and swings his arms side to side. That's kind of warming up his shoulders. That's all good stuff. And that's stuff you can do before you race. So if you're not able to warm up, if you're doing a triathlon and you're not able to warm up in the pool, there's movements that you can do on land to get you ready to start your race strong.
Yeah, I use the bands as well for some kind of lat things, either it was one arm, you know, kind of like I'm doing the swim, or both of them with a light resistance. So it was very fluid and easy. I didn't want to go too hard, but I wanted to go through the motions to warm the body up, but also touch on the muscles a little bit pre-warm up in the swim, because you only have so many minutes really out there. Maybe how many of us actually take the full 15 minutes before the race? Like, okay, the water's open, get out there. And then you're trying to get back in time and get your wetsuit all adjusted and all that kind of stuff. And then you sit on the shore or, you know, waist deep water for 5 to 10 minutes. And like, oh, did it work? Hopefully it did. But there's always that, you know, how much do you do ahead of time? Do something. Unfortunately, in some of the bigger, longer distances, you can't get out in the water in time because of the conditions or whatever's available to you. So something on land, like with your bands that you've done before, I think pre-race.
Yeah, and last year I created a whole video of just a dry land type of warm up.
Yeah.
And I kind of just did what I like to do, my little dry land routine that I like to do. So it's kind of fun. It's different. It's useful. It benefits me because it not only warms up my muscles, but it gets my heart beat up and the blood flowing and all that stuff, benefits of a warm up.
We have a question from Sean regarding Training Peaks. He goes, "Hello, Wendy. I trust you are well." I know Wendy is well. "I've registered for the Chattanooga 70.3 in May of 2022 with a friend of mine. It'll be my first triathlon ever, and I have very limited athletics in my background. I am very seriously considering the full distance in Chattanooga in September, May, June. So, you know, a little bit later that year. I'm curious, which Training Peaks training plan would you recommend for me?" Sean was thinking about doing the beginner 70.3 plan starting at the end of January, or should he do the couch to 70.3 training plan as well, or start that one earlier? Wendy?
So again, all these questions about, you know, which plan to follow, it really just depends on the athlete's experience, current fitness level, and what the goals are. So I followed up with Sean a little bit, got a little more information about what he's currently doing. And, you know, with knowing now, you know, end of October, that he's training for 70.3 in May with a potential of doing an Ironman in September, gives him plenty of time to actually just train and follow a 70.3 plan ended in May, and then follow just an Ironman plan starting, let's say, you know, mid-June, early July for the September race. So he can actually follow two full, you know, training plans. I also encouraged him to say, you know, work on his running right now in the fall and follow maybe a half marathon or a single sport plan, you know, like a run, single sport run plan between now and when that beginner 70.3 plan starts, if that's the route he wants to go. And then I also, you know, the benefit of doing the couch 2 plan is it's a longer plan. The beginner plan is 16 weeks. The couch 2 70.3 is 24 weeks. So if he starts that now, then he's on a plan starting now, and it's giving him plenty of time to prepare for his first 70.3. Upon further follow-up and getting to know a little bit more about his current training, I thought the couch 2 plan was a little bit too basic for him to start now, because I don't want him to go backwards, because he's, even though he doesn't have a lot of athletic background, he's been running for a while and he's up to 8 mile run and he's up to a certain distance of swimming and biking. And so I thought maybe that's why I encouraged him to maybe train for a half marathon now before he starts a 16-week 70.3 plan. And I also encouraged him to start swimming, because swimming seemed to be his weaker sport. So that's another route that he might want to do, is a single sport swimming plan. And once, if he does send me a swim video for analysis, I'll be able to guide him further on what I recommend for his swimming. So there's so many options out there. Just getting a little bit of background about a person can go a long way in making the right recommendation.
I was thinking about running recently because I know we have individual running plans, and I've got a long time with 13, well, little, just over 12 months, I guess. Yeah, 13 months until Arizona Ironman next year. And you've talked to me about possibly doing maybe a half marathon. I can easily do a half marathon, but maybe a marathon before then. And then, of course, I'll do a half Ironman before then, too, as a kind of a see where I stand in the year. Mm-hmm. And I like what Sean has here with May and September, because that's a decent amount of time in between where, like you said, he can do two full plans back to back. And one will build, the fitness will build from the first one into the next one, and will make sense. With running, and maybe this is more toward me, but I hope you can the listeners can get something out of themselves. A friend of mine lives in Arizona, and we talk back and forth on text. And me being here in the Pacific Northwest, we have more hills versus Arizona when it comes to running and terrain. And I kind of gave him a little jab that, oh, look, your total elevation gain for your whatever mile run was 6 feet. I'll raise you 500 feet because my run, there's a lot of ups and downs. And he goes, I can't find more than 89 feet of elevation where I live, even on a bike ride. And it's like frustrating. The pros and cons of running hills for a flat course in the future.
I don't think there's ever a con of running hills. Okay. The benefits of hill running include strength, endurance, and it's almost speed work in disguise. And I say that because, you know, when you're doing speed work, you're really working on glute activation, the posterior chain activation, and you're doing, you know, intervals, threshold work, like let's just say at the track. When most people think of speed work, I think of speed work at the track, where you're getting your heart rate up and you're activating that posterior chain. You can get that same type of adaptation of high heart rate and posterior chain activation running hard up a hill. Sure, your speed is not the same as it would be on a flat course, but that speed from the hill training will translate and transfer, whatever you want to say, into flat land. And so I think before anyone does any type of speed workout, whether they do speed workouts on flats or hills, there's a certain form of hill running that's beneficial. So you just start with running hills without any focus of trying to put any type of effort or intensity. You just start by running hills. That's going to help strengthen your legs. That's going to help stronger legs will help your stride and your endurance. And then after you get some types of just general hill running, you're going out for a 45-minute hill run, you're going out for a 90-minute hill run, whatever you're going to do, you keep it in a low to moderate effort. You don't worry about heart rate because your heart rate's going to get high on the uphills. It's going to get low on the downhills. So heart rate is not your best gauge of how you're doing, but rate of perceived effort is. And then over time, you can say, okay, now I'm ready to incorporate some hill sprints or some hill intervals, like 2-minute intervals, 5-minute intervals, 20-minute intervals. And that'll change how hard you run them, what your rate of perceived effort is, depending on the length and the purpose and intention of the workout. And then after you do this block of hill training, which I always recommend, you know, as part of your base training, your off-season training, then you translate that strength and fitness and you go to the track. And then all of a sudden you're kind of whipping out some speed that you never knew you had because you've developed so much resilience in your legs and your heart and lungs from the hill training that it just makes that speed work feel easier. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And I got two things. One's a devil's advocate and one is just a question here. The striding, your strides are shorter going uphill. And I thought maybe you said or didn't say that it helps your stride when you're running uphill. But your stride is shorter.
Your legs are getting stronger.
Yes.
And stronger legs increase your stride.
Yes. Okay.
On flat. So when you're trying to learn how to run more efficiently, you want to make sure you have the proper rate. You want to work on your rate. And then to go faster, you maintain that rate and increase your stride. Yes. You don't want to increase your stride to try to go faster and in effect lose that stride rate.
You're talking about cadence of how many times your foot hits the ground.
Right. And the way you increase your stride is by running more and leg strength. When your legs are stronger, your stride will automatically, not automatically, but it's easier to increase your stride without losing that rate because you have stronger legs, which is what hill running does.
Okay, here's the other one. The question is, trying to maintain the same pace when you're going uphill. Let's say you're going out for a run, mm-hmm. like I'm going out for a run, and I'm running right around, let's say I'm at 9 right now, just mm-hmm. for the first couple miles, I'm doing 9s. And then I come to my first hill. Would you want to try to maintain the 9 or no. let the hill just do what it does and you just kind of go through it and then watch your heart rate?
You let the, okay, and all comes back to what's the workout intention? What's your goal? What's your purpose? What's your why? When you're just starting to do hills, you want to keep the effort the same. So let's say your effort on approaching the hill at a 9-minute mile, your effort is a 5. As you run uphill, if you're not doing any structured, intentional interval training, as you approach the hill and your goal is to maintain an RPE of 5, you run up the hill at whatever pace allows you to maintain an RPE of 5.
So that you could use heart rate as the indicator there.
Right. You can use heart rate or just your own perceived effort. Over time, as you get more fit, maintaining that rate of perceived effort of a 5 up the hill, theoretically, you'll end up starting to go faster without putting in the effort. That's a sign of fitness.
Yes.
Now, if your effort is to go up the hill and hammer that hill because you personally just want to do it for like a Strava segment win or something like that, or if that was the intention of the workout was to do some hill sprints and trying to maintain a certain pace because you know what you're capable of doing, then that's going to be a different answer. But so hopefully I answered your question. That's why it's beneficial to use pace, heart rate of perceived effort, and monitoring all of that in one workout mm-hmm. will give you a lot of feedback on what your intention was and then what you actually did.
See, I think when I'm doing my hills, and I've got plenty of them around here, I'm looking at my route. I know where my route is. I know the mileage of mm-hmm. if I go this way or that way and how many miles I can go depends on what direction I go.
Right.
But I only have a mile and a half of flat road. Half this way. So maybe I have a mile and a quarter that's flat if I want to just do that before I leave anywhere. But then it's going to be downhill and uphill. I find, though, if I can, and I watch my heart rate, it's like, let's see if I can push through this hill while maintaining the same stride and pace and watch mm-hmm. my heart rate. And by doing this over and over again, I'm going to be more conditioned to hit that hill and try to maintain that heart rate. And the same, the pace, not the heart rate, but the pace. Right. Because if I feel I do this, then I'm going to be stronger for those moments on a flat course where I'm just going to push through the pace when I'm tired. So it's going to be a mental game for me. Mm-hmm. How hard can I push through this physical challenge of going up hills when I get tired at the later part of a marathon, for example, when I am tired again? Oh, I'm tired. Well, push through it. It's flat. It shouldn't be I'm building that success in my head, but
right,
I totally. Can go up a hill at the same pace. I know I'm at mile 20. I'll just imagine, even though it's flat, I'm pushing through the hill and I'm stronger and I've got that experience in the bank.
Oh yeah. And again, I think any hill training, you make a good point. It's all about getting that mental confidence. Hmm. It's mental as well as physical. So as long as you know what your intention is and what you're trying to accomplish by what you're doing on the hills, that's the most critical component. Is every athlete has a different training plan, different training details. As long as they understand the intention of what they're doing, and if they go above and beyond, like let's say your goal for the next 12 weeks is to maintain a heart rate up this hill of 150 beats. If that's your goal, then over time, maintaining a heart rate of 150 beats, you will start to go faster while still maintaining 150 beats. Go for it. If your goal is to maintain the same effort today, tomorrow, then maintain that same effort and don't worry, monitor your heart rate. If your goal is to run these hills by effort, monitoring your heart rate, it'll give you good feedback. So there's, you know, there's a lot involved, but it always goes back to what's the purpose, what's the intention. I think that's so important. And I think athletes, especially athletes who are self-coached, lose focus on the intention and what they're trying to achieve, because then they get caught up. Ooh, I'm going faster. I'm going to hammer up the hill, and then they could get injured, you know, or is the intention, I know a lot of people on Strava now, is the intention to, work as hard as you can so you have more kudos on Strava. That's fine. That's great. Whatever works for you, just as long as you're honest and open with what you're trying to do.
Hey, we want to encourage you to send us some questions to help create some content for the program. You can do that by going to the T2 Endurance Group on Facebook. You can go to Instagram and leave messages there. Go to endurancehour.com, email us, leave a comment on iTunes, on YouTube, whatever you want, and we'll use your questions and go in depth for our programs for the podcast. So that, for today, we'll wrap up our episode. So thank you very much for listening, for watching. Until next time, for Wendy Mader, I'm Dave Erickson. Have a great week of training, racing, or recovery. Adios.
Adios.